You are all my servants from now on. Whether you want to serve me alive or dead is immaterial to me.
Master! Master! See what I have brought thee!
The servant hobbled to his master, the only one who had ever shown him any kindness or consideration. He did not care about his lord's horrible appearance or the stench. Anyway, the master always hid himself behind his cloak. Furthermore, he was a scholar, but languished in exile, unrecognized.
Bring it to me, faithful one,
said his master.
Yes, master,
he replied and handed him the scroll.
Ah, it is from Khemri. Where did you find it, my most loyal servant?
I stole it, master, from the merchant.
Oh, what a shame. Did you harm him?
Alas, master, his head came off.
The master wagged his wizened finger.
I hope you hid the evidence.
Yes, master, but I kept the head. I thought you might want it for something.
Out for a bite. This is the War Games Orchard. Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Nathan Stone, and today we are going to dive into the lore of the vampires. Hold up, you say, cleverly knowing that I've already done an episode or two on vampires? Yes, well, you see, these past couple of weeks have not gone to plan. The episode that you were going to get today would have been Scott and I talking about the Warhammer Total War video game and the new Games Workshop Warhammer the Old World game that is currently under development. Alas, I had some microphone problems, and the last part of my last episode, the episode on Khorne Berserkers, as well as the entirety of my recording of the episode with Scott, were ruined. On the plus side, it turned out that my microphone is still alive. It's just the cord, the XLR cord, that had malfunctioned, and I've gotten a new XLR cord and everything sounds great again. This is very, very good because the difference between a $15 XLR cord and a $150 microphone is quite significant. Today we're going to do something that we didn't do in those early episodes about the vampires, and that is tell the stories of the vampires of Warhammer Fantasy. The Vampire Counts books from 5th to 8th edition are littered with incredible stories and narratives that should be shared. It turns out that the vampires of the Old World have a lot of very human motivations, and that's kind of what I wanted to highlight today, as well as just celebrate good storytelling. We're going to look at some tales from the 5th, 6th, and 7th edition Vampire Counts army books today, a celebration of the lore of the vampires, which I thought was only fitting considering Games Workshop's newest previews where they've shown off new vampire sculpts for Age of Sigmar. I've seen a lot of takes on these miniatures online, and I have to tell you, I kind of really like them. I really like the sculpt with the flowing hair with the bats in it, the bat-haired lady. I don't know if she has a name as of yet. I'm recording this before all of the big previews drop on Saturday, but from what I've seen so far, I am liking this aesthetic a whole lot. Not really models that I would choose for Warhammer Fantasy, because the Age of Sigmar line tends to be a little bit more over the top, but that one vampire model has me thinking about an army of vampires that would be just super cool. And another thing that makes me ever more curious about Age of Sigmar. Before we sink our teeth into these stories, I do have some things that I would like to share with you today. Firstly, is that I tried a new game recently. I tried the game Warcry with a friend of mine. He had just picked it up over the Christmas holidays, and he got the two forces in the starter set painted up, and we had a game with one of my other friends. This is a very interesting game. It's two warbands somewhere in Age of Sigmar, someplace really nasty, duking it out and trying to achieve various objectives. It's very fast-paced, it's super easy to pick up and learn. Kind of the modern style of Games Workshop games where the core rules are all very simple, very intuitive, and the complexity comes in through the rules on the models and warbands themselves. There's some very neat mechanics which I've not seen before in a Games Workshop game, including at the beginning of each battle round where you roll 6 dice and the number of doubles, triples, and quadruples that you get on those dice determine what abilities you can use during the turn. And even if you don't roll a lot, you roll singles, that gives you a better chance of moving first in that turn. A very interesting game, very fast-paced. Took us a while to play it because we were just learning, but I think you could knock out games very quickly, 30 to 45 minutes. There's only 3 turns in a game, which makes it very frantic, makes it very bloody, and makes you really think about your positioning and where you want your models to be, because you don't have all that much time to do things. Kind of like early days Warhammer and 40K, honestly. I played as the Age of Sigmar Dark Elves, I believe they're the Kainites, and my buddy played as the Chaos Cultists that are on fire, the Fire Worshipper ones. I should have looked up their names before this, I apologize. Though you've probably seen their models at this point, so you know which ones I am talking about. It was a fun game, and my buddy's looking at doing a little bit of a campaign with these. He's picked up some more of those warbands, and I think it's going to be 4 of us playing, and it should be a lot of fun if we can get this going. Hobby-wise, Scott had 3D printed me some elven obelisks. These are kind of your classic elven pointy standing stones, and it's the first 3D printed thing I've ever had. Scott has a printer at his work that he's got access to. He started using it to print off bigger terrain pieces. It's really interesting up close. I think the quality of printer he has is very suitable for terrain where it's a little bit rough, but the detail's pretty okay. I don't think you'd want to do actual miniatures on there. And I've been working on tidying those up, and I'm going to make them into terrain pieces. My terrain collection is adequate, but it's not great. My wife and I have a very small space in the downtown where we live, and I have to be quite careful about the things that I own and making sure that we're not filling up our space here. We love our little apartment. It is very small, and that means that I do have to make some difficult choices hobby-wise. I can't have the mountains of terrain that I would like. I'm hoping to have at least one of those obelisks done in the coming week, and I plan on throwing those pictures up on the Warhammer Orchard Facebook page if I can. Now for news. Oh boy, do I have some things here for you today. I've had to make some notes because I got a lot of things to mention. And first up, I have done a couple of guest spots on podcasts recently that I should highlight. Just a couple of weeks ago, I sat down with Joshua from the Crown of Command podcast, and we talked all about the history of the Night Goblin fanatics. These little guys are hilarious. They've been in the game since first edition, if you can believe that, and they've had some really interesting background change throughout. Their fluff starts out quite dark and then sort of lightens up over the eras, and they have some really interesting rules that come about in the earlier editions. If you like this show, if you like my deep dives, I think you'll really like that episode of Crown of Command. And I was also on the Flail of Skulls podcast. I was on it back in December, but the episode came out in January, and this is a Lizardmen army list building exercise for 5th edition. There was 3 of us, myself, Joe, and Casper, and we all built different Lizardmen lists for 5th edition and talked about them a bit. I built a very narrative list based on the migration of the Red-Crested Skinks during the war with Clan Pestilence, and it was only very slightly illegal. I messed up on a few small things and one really big thing, and it's really dumb. And if you go and listen to that episode, you absolutely have my permission to come at me and laugh at me about what I messed up. You can actually hear me in the background of the episode when Joe and Casper call me out on my mistake. I think I say something like, "Oh God, that's embarrassing." But please do listen to that episode. It's tons of fun. Hopefully I'll get a chance to record with those guys again, if they'll have me back after that mistake. The other two made very good lists. Joe actually makes an entire scenario between the lizard men and the forces of the Vampire Coast. Casper makes a terrifying competitive lizard men list. If you're into Hero Hammer, if you're into the lizard men, listen to that podcast. It's Flail of Skulls. That one's been out for a few weeks now. And you can come and laugh at me after you listen to that one. Next up on the list is a project that I'm excited to tell you guys about. This is the Hero Hammer fan magazine. This again is for those fans of the Warhammer Fantasy 4th and 5th edition Hero Hammer eras and fans of 90s Games Workshop games. Things like Manowar, 2nd edition 40K, the properties that we loved during the bright, colorful, wonderful 90s. Hero Hammer is a fan-made magazine that I was lucky enough to get to work on with so many talented people in our community, and it's going to launch in early February. There have already been a couple of teasers up on the various Warhammer Facebook pages, at least the Hero Hammer page, the Crown of Command, and I believe the Warhammer Fantasy General page as well. I have to tell everyone, because I have access to the articles and the pictures and everything that's going into this magazine. Guys, you are going to be blown away by this. This is the return of those 90s white dwarfs again. It is incredible what this team has put together. I'm a very small part of this. I have contributed a lore article on Night Goblins and Skarsnik that will feature in the magazine. Other than that, I can't claim credit for any of this. These guys are working so hard. They're getting it edited. It's so professionally done. If you're a Warhammer fan, check this out. It's going to come out in February, and then it's either going to be bi-monthly or quarterly. I don't know if that's been nailed down yet. But as soon as you see this thing, it's going to hit you right in the feels. It's going to transport you back to 1995 or 6. And you are going to have a great time reading through this. We've got lore, we've got battle reports, we've got modeling, painting articles, interviews. This has been an incredible thing to see come together. Do yourself a favor and check this thing out. It's going to be so much fun. And like so many good things in life, it's not going to cost you a single penny. Another thing I'd like to tell you about is I have started dabbling in video a little bit. Scott and I are looking at putting together battle reports and expanding the orchard to the YouTube Twitch space, but that is a little ways off. For now, I'm just trying to get used to creating and editing video. I have a little video that I shot on my phone that is 5 reasons why you should play Warhammer Fantasy in 2021, and I'm currently trying to get that edited up and get it out. It's going to be a little bit rough, but it should be a lot of fun. I will let you guys in the community know as soon as that's up, and you can give me some feedback on that. It's all a learning process, and it's very exciting, though. I'm super excited to start making clickbaity YouTube videos. The very last thing I'm going to tell you guys about today is our Patreon. Our Wargames Orchard Patreon is the place to find bonus content for this show to help us out, and there are no tiers whatsoever. You can donate a dollar or as many dollars as you want and access all of our bonus content. This month's bonus episode is all about the Shadow of the Horned Rat, the incredible Warhammer Fantasy video game that started them all. Scott and I break it down. We have tons of fun discussing the incredible story and cutscenes in this game, the very janky controls, and everything in between. Also, I have released today on the Patreon a little story from the Dogs of War book, which is all about a mercenary general named El Cadavo and his run-in with the Lizardmen. You can hear that story as well on the Patreon. Eventually, we're going to have tons of things on there. And I am committed to releasing a steady stream of bonus content. If you like the show, please support the show. Even a dollar will get you full access to all of that bonus stuff, and the value just keeps getting better there. That's enough of a shameless plug for this episode. Let's dive into the red, juicy meat of things here. I have several stories that I'm going to share with you today. We're going to start off in the 5th edition Vampire Counts Army Book. This was one of the last books released for the Hero Hammer era. It came out in 1999, just a scant year from the big 6th edition reboot. You can tell that this book almost has a 6th edition feel to it, in that it is far darker and more muted than the bright books of the rest of the era. It was a very good book and gave us a lot of insight into the vampires, introduced us to the vampire counts' families and the bloodlines. On this stop, we're going to look at a story from the perspective of Wallach, Grand Master of the Order of Blood Dragons. He was a really interesting character in the fluff that doesn't appear in any Vampire Counts army book beyond this edition. And this story takes place after the fall of Blood Keep and the scattering of the Blood Knights. When we see Wallach here, he is rebuilding his forces and licking his wounds. And this story gives us a very interesting insight into his mind, how he thinks, and perhaps how vampires in general think, which is why I wanted to share it with you today. From atop the ruined tower of the keep, Wallach, Grand Master of the Order of the Blood Dragons, gazed into the night. He stood alone, deep in thought, his iron will turned inwards, his mind traveling the dark paths of the distant past. Memories flickered past him like corpse candles. He still recalled the dimness of his human senses. He wondered what it would be like to breathe again, to feel the blood flow through his veins. What the world would look like if observed through the limited senses of a living man. How much more could he see and hear now? The night was full of sounds and shapes. He saw how the swirling mists of dark magic enveloped the blood keep like a shroud, forming nightmarish images. He could hear the howls of the wolves in the mountains, 100 miles from the point where he was standing. Yes, he could hear and see everything. As his fingers touched the blade of his ancient sword, memories flowed back. So many had died by that sword. He remembered the glory of the great wars of old. Blood had flowed like wine then. He had slain innumerable foes. Dwarf lords, elven princes, counts of the empire, all had fallen before the might of his sword. Good times, he thought. But other memories were not so pleasant. He also remembered the day when the Templars of the White Wolf had broken down the gates of the Blood Keep. Mikkel, his favorite son, was impaled by a fanatical warrior priest of Sigmar. Aurora, his chosen bride, had been beheaded by the Reichsmarschall during the battle before he could intervene. His male fingers curled round the hilt of his crimson sword. One day, he thought, vengeance will be mine. I have all eternity to wait. And indeed he had. He was immortal. There would be time enough. Wallach turned back to the balcony door and stepped into the dim, reddish glow of the torches. The great feasting hall of the Order was full. White warriors stood on guard, while the 16 undying immortals, the last of his vampire knights and their unearthly beautiful brides, sat around the great table. In the dim light of the ruined hall, their eyes glittered with an unspeakable hunger, for tonight was the night of the blood feast. As one, they turned to face him and bowed. Wallach motioned them to continue their revelries and took his place at the head of the feasting table. The hall was filled with eerie sounds as the wail of banshees carried from the dungeons. While their howls would bring death instantly to any living man, for an immortal vampire, their cries were sweet music, filled with the lonely beauty of the cold grave. At a single word from Wallach, the room fell silent. The blood chalice, the great relic of the vampiric order, was brought to him by his loyal servants. He grasped the ancient cup with both hands and drank deep. An overwhelming sensation, pain more severe than a sword blade, ecstasy more potent than any human sense could endure, flowed through his body. He felt power and exultation fill him. He was godlike, invincible, deadly. As he passed the blood chalice on, he studied his undead knights as they drank. The ancient vows of the Brotherhood were exchanged as the chalice passed from one hand to another. The splendor of the armor and the coats of arms of his knights echoed their past glories, strengthening his belief that there was no power in the world to oppose him. His warriors had gathered. The standard of the Blood Dragon would fly above his armies once more. He would break the backs of mortal lords of this world, for who could stand against him? There were no more true warriors left on this world. He had fought and defeated the greatest of them during times past, when being a warrior meant something. Now the world was old and there were no heroes left. The old races of the dwarves and the elves had grown weak, while humans had become soft, decadent, and lazy, and Wallach's strength had but grown over the years. Now was the time of the reckoning. Now was the time of war. I like this story for a couple of reasons. Firstly, it gives us the sense that, though immortal, vampires have the same types of cravings that you and I would, though they may spend more time alone than a normal human would, they still will seek out the company of others of their kind. The idea that Wallach had a love, a vampire maiden who was his chosen bride, and that he mourned her death, and that has left him even more bitter, these are all very human emotions. I like the idea that even for undead monsters, there is enough semblance of humanity left in them that they will do things like have feast days, even though they're feasting on blood, and seek out entertainment in the banshees. And I love that little interplay there, because it's not noted anywhere else that vampires enjoy the wailing of banshees as mortals would enjoy music. I just think that's such a neat interplay between those two types of undead. What's interesting about this story, too, is it gives you this sense of what vampires get emotionally out of drinking blood. This great feeling of power that they could take on the world. We don't get a sense of Wallach's bravado until he drinks from this blood chalice, and then he kind of goes on about how he is the greatest warrior in the world. And that explains a lot about the vampire's love for blood, not only to survive, but to have this great feeling. They describe it as an ecstasy more potent than anything the human senses could endure. That sounds good, right? Sound like, sign me up. For our next couple of stories, we're going to go to the Vampire Counts 6th edition book. I think this is my favorite Vampire Counts book of all time, not counting the 4th edition Undead book because it was more than this, but as far as books sharing the title goes, I think this was the absolute best. We got some incredible stories in this book. We got themed list, we had incredible vampire powers. It just doesn't get better than this if you are a fan of the blood drinkers. This story follows a Bretonian questing knight and his run-in with a blood dragon vampire. Let us now enter the deep forests of Bretonia. Lambert de Liliaz was riding along a narrow path in the very heart of the forest of Chalon. Under the dense foliage, the light of day was reduced to a gray haze, but following the tracks left by the one he was hunting was not difficult. It seemed that no attempt at all had been made to conceal them. Alas, what an arrogant villain this must be who did not fear the rightful vengeance of the knights of Bretonia. Only that morning, during his long quest for the Grail, Lambert had passed through a woodcutter's village at the edge of the forest. The poor men living there had pleaded with them to save them from the Red Knight of Chalon. They had told him in despair how this terrible warrior had ridden into their village over the last 4 nights to abduct their sons and daughters. He was clad in a blood-red suit of armor and mounted on a huge black warhorse. The device on his shield was that of a coiled black dragon on a red field. Lambert had recognized him as one of the cursed knights of blood. Certainly, he thought, this was a trial set by the lady on his quest for the Grail, and so he entered the dark forest. In the dim light of the sunset, the path led him to a clearing, and there he was. Standing tall and proud in the center of the small glade, the vampire seemed to be waiting for him. He was wearing no helm, and Lambert could see his long mane of thin black hair that contrasted so intensely with his pale complexion and crimson plate armor. The Knight of Blood smiled enigmatically, examining Lambert as he made his way into the clearing.
"I am Lambert de Liliaz, Knight of Bretonnia. Mount your steed and prepare to fight. May the lady give me the strength to strike you down and put an end to your evil deeds," sounded the proud challenge of the questing knight.
After a few seconds of silence, the Red Knight spoke in a calm and confident voice.
"You should not be so concerned about the fate of those commoners, young Lambert. They are not worth what you are risking, and this fight is meaningless. You have no hope of defeating me, and I have no interest in such an uneven confrontation. Furthermore, I am already sated with the blood of those peasants, and I do not need to take your life. Right away, boy."
What arrogance, thought Lambert, a deep rage overcoming his reason. He lowered his lance and spurred his warhorse, charging the vampire with the cry, "For the lady and the king!" The Red Knight did not move a muscle, and Lambert's lance found its mark. The steel tip of his lance pierced the red armor, and the shaft buried itself deep in the undead warrior's flesh. The lance shattered as the knight galloped by his opponent. The Bretonnian was immediately filled with a sense of triumph. Nothing could withstand such a terrible impact. He had vanquished the abomination. Lambert halted his warhorse and turned it around. The vampire was still standing. The lance had penetrated his chest just under the collarbone, and the tip was now protruding from below his shoulder blades. The creature turned slowly towards Lambert, pulling the thick wooden shaft out of his body, and dropped it with an unnatural nonchalance. Only a very thin stream of blood trickled from his gaping wound.
"A good jousting display, Knight of Bretonnia. But I told you that you cannot win this combat. I will not repeat myself again. Now leave and live."
Lambert was astonished by the resilience of the vampire. He felt a strong urge to flee as far as possible from such a powerful enemy, but he controlled his fear and answered,
"Perhaps you are right, creature of the night. Perhaps I cannot defeat you, but I am a knight, and I will not surrender. Death is preferable to cowardice. Defend yourself."
Drawing his sword, Lambert spurred his steed once more. When he reached the enemy, he swung his sword in a wide, deadly arc, with all the strength of his arm and his charging warhorse. This time, the vampire reacted. With blinding speed, his left hand raised and caught Lambert's wrist in an iron grasp, while the right stopped the charging warhorse. The sudden halt of their impetus shocked both the animal and the young knight. They found themselves immobilized and helpless, at the mercy of that unnatural predator. For a second, the eyes of the two knights met. Looking into those two pools of ancient darkness, Lambert understood that there were powers in the world against which he could not prevail. Then the vampire unhorsed Lambert with a twist of his powerful arm and flung him like a puppet into the trees. The Bretonnian crashed against a trunk, and darkness engulfed him. When Lambert opened his eyes, surprised that he was still alive, the Red Knight was in front of him, a sad smile on his thin lips. Lambert realized that he had been thrown over the saddle of his own horse. He tried to move, but his body was overwhelmed by pain, and his muscles would not respond to his will.
"I'm sparing your life, Lambert. You fought with courage, and I'm going to leave this forest. You have saved your precious peasants, so your pride is intact. Now let your good steed take you to the village. There you will rest and heal, so that you can continue your quest. If you complete it, you will become a more interesting opponent, and maybe we will have a fairer duel if we meet again. My name is Caleb of the Order of the Blood Dragon, and if you learnt something from today's experience, you will not come after me before you are truly ready. Fare thee well, Knight of Bretonnia."
After the vampire disappeared into the darkness, Lambert realized that he had indeed learnt something. He had been taught a hard but necessary lesson. Only now did he understand that he was lacking one of the most important knightly virtues. To reach perfection and see the Grail, a knight needed humility. He praised the lady for this revelation, and then slipped once more into unconsciousness. Caleb observed the vanquished young knight until his horse had taken him out of sight. The vampire couldn't help feeling that in the future he would meet Lambert again, and that he might come to regret not having killed him here. He had fought enough Grail knights to learn not to underestimate them. But also, that boy reminded him of a distant past, a time when he was not doomed to drink the blood of men to survive. The Knight of Blood shrugged off those uneasy feelings, mounted his black charger, and went on his way out of the forest. The light of the full moon caught the reflection on Caleb's shield, revealing, just for an instant, his old device, a blazon which had long ago been covered by the Blood Dragon icon. It was a fleur-de-lis. This is a story that has always grabbed me in this book. I really like the struggle of the Bretonian knight against this vampire, and the vampire always being in cool control of their altercation. There's something about it that really screams a classic Blood Dragon story and also a classic Bretonian story. I've always found the Blood Dragons to be a subtly interesting faction. Not so much on the surface, but once you get past the classic Black Knight, undead cavalier thing, you can find a lot of personality with the Blood Dragons. We're going to leave them for now, and we're going to stay with the 6th edition Vampire Counts book. The next story we're going to look at is about the Necrarchs. I think I said in the Vampire Counts episodes that we did last year that the Necrarchs are my favorite of the vampire bloodlines. Most of that has to do with my love of the classic Bela Lugosi Nosferatu. Something about the aesthetic of the bald vampire with the long ears, long fingers is just so unsettling to me. More than any other depiction of a vampire, that one just kind of gives me the shivers. And I've always loved classic movie monsters, so it was a natural fit for me to love the Necrarchs. You also get a dash of mad scientist with them, which is a fun quirk for them to have. This next story tells the tale of an unlikely vampire hunter and his confrontation with a Necrarch vampire. The spiral stairway to the crypt was ancient and dank. Shadows danced on the walls at the light of Nero's lantern. He reached the bottom of the staircase and tore his way through the cobwebs obstructing the archway. Nero entered the room and at once felt like he was no longer stepping on a stone floor. The room was covered in moist soil, the foul mold of that accursed forest. That was how the vampires recovered their supernatural energies in their daily slumber. They needed to lie in the womb of that evil land. Then he saw the coffin and froze. Holding his breath, inch by inch, he approached. After reaching it, he put down his lantern and prepared his wooden stake and mallet for the job that he had come to do. He slowly removed the lid of the coffin and... empty! There was no trace of the body. He had been fooled. Yet something small moved suddenly in the furthest end of the coffin. Nero raised his lantern. The creature it illuminated was born out of a nightmare. It was a rotten human head standing on 8 articulated legs, like those of a huge spider. Certainly this was one of the experiments of the Dark Master of the Tower. The creature hissed a disgusting, "Master!" and scuttled towards a dark corner of the room. Nero moved a few steps in that direction and saw a great stone sarcophagus, carved in strange symbols. They reminded him of the scrolls from the ancient kingdom of Khemri that he had studied in the past. Before he could make a move, the heavy slab covering the sarcophagus fell aside with a loud thud. Then a shadow darker than the surrounding darkness moved out of it and into the chamber. The air seemed to chill in the crypt.
The only detail Nero could clearly see were the eyes of the vampire, two gleaming jewels of ancient evil.
So, miserable mortal, you thought you could catch Nicodemus unprepared?
Whispered a voice from the darkness. A voice that reached Nero's innermost fears and overwhelmed his senses with sheer horror. Nero gave a shrieking cry of frustrated anger, immediately followed by a series of arcane words of power. From his eyes erupted two black rays of pure dark magic that struck the vampire and seemed to engulf him. The creature was surprised by the violence of the attack, hardly managing to disperse the dark energies that threatened to destroy him. Nicodemus raised his arms and chanted aloud in the language of his long-lost homeland. Answering his call, a dozen skeleton warriors clawed their way out of the crypt's floor and started to move towards Nero. As the circle closed, a strange smile appeared on the thin lips of the human.
Wrong move, Nicodemus.
Nero assumed the same posture as the vampire and uttered a series of commanding words. The skeletons stopped their advance. Nicodemus felt his control on the mindless servants fading, his sorcery challenged by another powerful mind. He struggled to maintain control of his minions, and the two wizards, the living and the undead, started a titanic battle of wills. Nicodemus could feel the vast flow of dark magic that his opponent was channeling, and at the same time the subtle level of control he was using, in an attempt to exploit any gap in Nicodemus's defenses. How was that possible? Since when had his student reached such a high level of mastery? Slowly the skeletons turned and began to advance on their creator. Nero started to laugh out loud.
You're defeated, you pathetic monster! You have lost your arrogance all of a sudden. I am the master now.
The vampire moved back until he was pressed against the wall, and then made a last attempt to regain control of the skeletons. Nero moved forward and kept the pressure high. He almost felt pity for the rotten monster that had once been his master, and who was now desperately cornered in his own crypt, betrayed by his best apprentice. Then the vampire abruptly ceased the struggle. Nero was surprised by this apparent surrender, and stared at his former master with suspicion. Was he really going to give up? Nicodemus spoke in a slow, patronizing tone.
I see that your knowledge of the black arts has grown to an impressive level, but you must consider you are just a human, and humans are fragile. Their life so easily crushed out of their weak bodies. Don't you think, in your eagerness to defeat me, you have come a bit too close?
Then the vampire darted towards Nero, literally moving through the skeletons, which exploded as if they were made of fragile clay when the creature hit them. Too late, Nero realized his mistake. When he was young in Tali, he had heard legends of the great strength of the Lords of the Night, but he had never seen that in his former teacher, who resembled a rotting carcass. He had never imagined that Nicodemus could move so fast, never imagined that he could burst through those skeletons so easily, never imagined that those wizened hands could break his neck so quickly. The vampire threw away the broken puppet that was Nero's body as the skeletons collapsed to the ground. Then he staggered back towards his sarcophagus. Rest. He needed rest. The human had wisely attacked in the middle of the day when Nicodemus's powers were at their weakest. The vampire could feel the presence of the sun even this deep underground. After putting the heavy lid back into place and before falling into his deep slumber, Nicodemus reflected on what had happened. How was it possible that a mere scholar, a creature that had been learning necromancy for such a short time, how long had it been anyway? Maybe 30 years? Could have become a match for his powers. The vampire had studied the black arts for thousands of years. He had been taught by the great necromancer himself, he who challenged death and created the discipline of undeath. How was it possible? Humans were weak. How could they challenge the mastery of one of the line of Osorin? He clearly remembered the flame of Nero's life extinguished by the force of his own grasp as the human passed away. Only then did Nicodemus understand. There was the answer.
That was the reason why humans could progress in the necromantic arts faster than any vampire. Humans were obsessed with the fear of dying and passing away from the world and disappearing. Their lifespan was so short that they had to find a way to cheat death in the space of a few decades. The blood kiss brings immortality to vampires, but immortality also means that vampires lose that most powerful driving force, the fear of death. At this revelation, Nicodemus was at first dismayed, but then he started to think of the problem as a challenge. He needed to find another apprentice so that he could study him much more closely. Maybe there was something that could be learned from the humans he used to prey upon. From that night on, Nicodemus would experiment on his victims with a new and refreshed scholar's interest. This story is a wonderful little wizard's duel that, if you haven't heard it for the first time, has the fun little twist where the witch hunter turns out to be a necromancer the whole time and the vampire's own student. I love the idea of this duel as a skirmish game, and I've always kind of wanted to play it. Perhaps do it as a master necromancer versus a level 2 or 3 vampire. Have them fight for the crypt and control of the skeletons each turn. I think you could do a really neat little skirmish game with that. Something in the feel of the sorceress duel between Gandalf and Saruman that Games Workshop published as a little mini game that you could play with your miniatures and White Dwarf. But have it with this theme. I think you could do something really fun with that. This is my favorite story, maybe in any of the Vampire Counts books, and it's another one that gives you a great amount of insight into how vampires think. I love the dummy coffin that the Necrarch has set up with his little spider head thing standing guard. I really enjoy the after-battle thinking that the vampire is doing about what motivates humans and why his apprentice was almost able to best him in the realm of dark magic. The whole thing is just such a neat little sliver of the vampire experience. Our last story today comes from the 7th edition Vampire Counts Army book. Not my favorite one, but contains a very nice little scene with Vlad von Karstein. Vlad is one of the most interesting characters in the whole of the old world. His motivations were always so different. Most vampires didn't think as big as Vlad thought. He's certainly not the only vampire to ever try and conquer the empire or carve out his own domains, but Vlad, I think, was the most far-seeing of them. And I do wonder, would the empire have been stronger if Vlad had succeeded in his attack on Altdorf and become the immortal vampire emperor? Think of all of the incredible technology of the empire, the strength of their armies, augmented by the strength of a vampire and undying legions. Do you think they might have been able to see off the end times if that had been the case? You would have had centuries of vampiric rule. Or would the whole thing have collapsed under the weight of the narcissism and egos of the various vampires that would have no doubt come to control each of the provinces? And how would the humans have fared under Vlad's rule? It's such an interesting what-if scenario there. This scene, titled A Terror Unleashed, describes to us the night that Vlad von Karstein, from the top of Castle Drachenhof, first summoned the armies of the undead so that he could march upon the empire. Clouds swathed the night sky. Only the pale and green tinge of Morslieb shone down upon the gloomy forests of Sylvania. The fell light of the chaos moon, harbinger of evil, like a throbbing eye it pulsed down over the peaks of the World Edge Mountains, bathing the lands in dark magic. A smaller glow greeted the dire orb, spilling sickly from the brazier atop the rampart of Drachenhof Castle. Warpstone hissed and bubbled in magical fire, sputtering noxious smoke into the still air, illuminating the soaring towers of the keep with a nauseating hue. A tall figure strode through the fog, causing it to swirl in vortexes that split into the moaning faces of souls trapped in eternal torment. The magical fumes coiled about Vlad von Karstein, seeming to paw at his pallid face and seep into his body as he stood at the battlement. The vampire count's eyes blazed with power as he gazed out across Sylvania, his immortal stare reaching out beyond the fetid woodlands to the dark forests of the Empire. Vlad brought forth a great book bound in human skin. It crawled within his grasp, trying to break free, but Vlad's grip was like iron. As he opened its ancient pages, the archaic words of Nagash, scrawled in blood, writhed upon the parchment woven from human sinew, trying to hide their secrets from the vampire. With the magic of the warpstone fueling his will, Vlad turned his eyes to the ragged pages. He fixed the spells in place, extending his unyielding will through a grim stare, wrestling with the powerful energies coursing through his body. Vlad forced himself to concentrate. His veins burned and his skin raged with agony, but Vlad steeled himself against the pain and began the ritual. The words came slowly at first, just a murmur upon the vampire's cold lips. They were ancient words, bastardized Necroharan and Elvish, concocted by the great necromancer as he sought to unravel the mysteries of life and death. With greater strength, Vlad spoke the horrifying incantations, his voice growing in volume. Dark magic burned within the warpstone smoke, coruscating in black waves around the vampire. Vlad raised his shaking clawed hands into the air. The Book of Nagash held in front of him by the power of the Count's infernal gaze. Like a storm breaking, Vlad's voice boomed out across his lands, carrying with it the magic of death and the energy of unlife. In long-abandoned gardens of Mor, dead things scraped at their stone coffins. Casket lids creaked and dusty earth shifted as corpses clawed their way to the surface. In the swamps, half-rotted creatures pulled themselves free from their sucking marshland graves. To the north, under the desecrated soil of Van Haldenschoss, skeletal hands tightened on sword hilts and spear shafts, and bones broken by battles of antiquity knitted together. To the east, upon the foothills of the mountains, the rune-carved lintels of prehistoric barrows burned with the vigor of undeath. Unearthly shrieks echoed through the streets and alleys of Drakenhof as the souls of the Von Drax victims surged back into the world seeking vengeance. The sound of thousands of fluttering wings resounded through the forests and grew louder. Blacker than the night sky, a heaving cloud of bats gathered about Drakenhof Castle, swooping and screaming, surrounding the blasted keep with a whirlwind of fangs and red eyes. The growling and howling of wolves joined the clamor as the dead beasts loped from the forests and prowled to and fro before the castle gates, awaiting the command of their new master. All across Sylvania, the living woke from their restless sleep, disturbed by the haunting whispers of their nightmares. The Book of Nagash closed with a thunderclap and fell to the flagstones at Vlad's feet, wisps of steam rising from its lead bindings. The Count of Sylvania could feel the dark magic that suffused his realm and could sense the legions rising from their graves. Once more, Vlad looked westward. Here, the nobles of the Empire squabbled and fought, allowing anarchy to reign and their people to die in famine and pointless war. Here, the greatest nation of the Old World rotted from within, soon to collapse under its own rancid dilapidation. Vlad would not allow that to happen. He would bring order where now there was mayhem. He would bring leadership where now there was weakness. Under his rule, the Empire would be united forever, with Vlad as its immortal emperor. Never again would the Empire fall prey to the petty schemes of mortal men. Alive or as the undead, the people of the Empire would serve their new emperor without question. Vlad's undying reign would sweep away the lawlessness and disorder for eternity. With the armies of the Empire at his command, nothing would stop Vlad, no force in this world or the next. This little scene is so evocative. I love all of it, especially the Book of Nagash, described as writhing and trying to fight Vlad and conceal its secrets from him. Sounds really neat. Kind of the classic Necronomicon vibe from Evil Dead, that kind of thing. In this, we really get a sense of Vlad's motivations when he marches on the Empire. I'm curious, you know, I might be on Team Vlad here. I really want to know what could have been under Emperor Vlad. Probably nothing good, but you never do know. I hope that this episode has given you a little bit more insight into the motivations, machinations, and just wants and desires of the vampires of the old world. It wasn't the episode that I had planned to release this week, but I'm really glad that I've done it. It's been a lot of fun revisiting these old stories and sharing them with you today. In my old career, I used to tell a lot of stories. I was a children's programmer at the local library, so I did things like puppet shows and story times, and I really miss that one aspect of the job, and it's nice to get to do a Warhammer story time every now and again with folks from all over the world, so thank you very much for listening. Before we go, I'm going to share with you just one last little thing from the 5th edition Vampire book, just a teeny tiny scene that I just really like.
I lie in my casket, dreaming. Oh, what dreams! When I was born, I cannot remember. It was so long, long ago now. When I was brought again to my immortality, I can bring it back to my mind, but it is dim. It was in the castle, the same castle that rises above me now. My castle. I can feel the weight of the stone and the dankness. The cool, moist dampness that is so good for my complexion. Has it not preserved me for so many centuries here in my tomb, in my casket of lead? For long years I have waited. Why do I awake now? What is it that has stirred me? I returned to my crypt for the last time long ago. There was strife in the castle then. Everyone perished. There was fire. I do not like fire. So I descended into the cool of my tomb. Now I have awoken. What sounds can I perceive echoing through these ancient halls? Is it laughter and music? The castle is occupied again. There are living, breathing, heaving, red-blooded beings here again. Knights! I always did love knights. Such strength, such good red blood. Nurtured on the venison and the good red wine of our land. Ah, the blood of the brave. Yes, I shall arise this night. I shall be arrayed in all my beauty. I shall take for myself a new lover. I tire of the old one. He is nothing but skin and bones.
Thanks again for listening, and happy wargaming. Thanks for listening to this episode of the War Games Orchard. If you've enjoyed this show, why not help us out by joining our Patreon? You can find us at patreon.com/wargamesorchard. There you'll be able to donate any amount of money to the show and access our bonus content. The bonus episode for this month is all about the Shadow of the Horned Rat, the excellent 1995 strategy video game all about a mercenary company and their unlikely quest to save the Empire from Grey Seer Thankwell. If Patreon's not your thing, please consider giving us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice and sharing this show with friends. If you'd like to get a hold of us, you can find us on the Warhammer Orchard Facebook page, or you can contact me directly at wargamesorchard@gmail.com.
Nosferatu, coming at you with my man Dub Dubs and the Bat Crew, Dracula, the king of my kind.